Hey, folks, one of today's Ring of Fire radio sponsors is News Voice. You can check them out at newsvoice.com/ring. As you know, news media has become more and more concentrated. And also, because of social media, we tend to live in news bubbles. One of the ways to combat this is a service that I use on a daily basis when I want to know the most I can about each individual story I talk about, News Voice. They bring together articles about news topics from different perspectives, both the right and the left. Now, I'm a little bit jaded, so I read this to find out exactly what kind of lies the right is going to use to combat the reality of the news stories that we see. But your mileage may vary, and at the very least, you'll get a well-rounded picture of any given story. News Voice, it's a website and app for iOS and Android. You can access for free if you go to newsvoice.com/ring. It gives you a personalized news feed by aggregating a mix of mainstream media sources, international sources, and independent media sources. Multiple sources are provided for each news story, so like I say, you get a well-rounded perspective on any given story. The whole site is fueled by crowdsourcing, so you can upvote stories you think are important so more people will see them. You can add stories to the site. You can add a source that's missing for a story. It's meant to be a completely open and democratized source for news that lets you get every side of every story. They also have a video interview series featuring guests from like Chris Hedges to Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez. You can go download the app for free right now by going to newsvoice.com/ring. That's newsvoice.com/ring. Welcome to Ring of Fire Radio. I'm Sam Cedar. Today on the show, Eileen Applebaum from the Center for Economic and Policy Research will explain how hedge fund kings will make huge profits from the bankruptcy of Sears. Angelo Carusone from Media Matters will tell us about a group of men who describe themselves as Western chauvinists called the Proud Boys. Heather Digby Parton from Salon will be here with the biggest news stories of the week. And award-winning documentary filmmaker Stephanie Sotag will be here to discuss her new film, The Devil We Know, about the cancer-causing chemical C8 that was dumped into the Ohio River Valley by DuPont. Don't forget, you can go to rofpodcast.com, sign up for the free one-hour version of the Ring of Fire radio podcast. And if you want the full show without commercials, become a member. That's the best way to support this show and to catch what you're missing. That's rofpodcast.com. Here to recap the biggest stories of the week, Heather Parton from Salon, or as you may know her, Digby. So, Heather, another strange week in American politics. Of course, we are now Less than 25 days, maybe I think close to 20 days, maybe even less than that from the midterm elections. We will talk about that a little bit later in the program. But I will say that everything that we talk about at this point is so implicated by these midterm elections. I've been going around saying, like, I don't know if things are going to get better in the short term, if the Democrats take the House. There will, of course, be hearings and some measure of accountability. At the very least, there's an incentive for Democrats, right, to provide some accountability. But I am quite sure that if the Democrats don't at least take the House, things are going to get much, much worse. And I'm talking across the board. And let's just start with this story that has been sort of unwinding over the course of the week. and that is the gruesome killing of a Washington Post columnist, Jamal Khashoggi. He is a was a U.S. resident. He was in Turkey with his fiance, seeking paperwork. He's a Saudi national seeking paperwork from the Saudi embassy in Istanbul to get married. And he went in and never came out. And subsequently, we have learned Turkish officials who apparently have bugged the heck out of their country. You know, people have known that, but apparently have perhaps some ability to record audio, maybe video, in the Saudi embassy, detail the killing and the dismemberment of this Saudi journalist. And I mean, this raises a lot of questions. But aside from our support of Saudi Arabia, which is no small thing in their creating a huge human catastrophe in Yemen, this is an example of sort of Trumpism spreading across the globe, like the lack of the U.S. being any type of ballast starts to open up a huge can of worms.
Oh, absolutely. And I think, I mean, I even read an article this past week stating from somebody quoted from within the inner circle or some association of with the inner circle in Saudi Arabia, that one of the reasons why MBS, Mohammed bin Salman, the young prince who is in charge of Saudi Arabia at the moment, and who is, you know, very likely to have been the person who ordered this gruesome killing in Turkey, that he was highly influenced by two things. One, that Vladimir Putin has been getting away with assassinating dissidents and you know, people he considers to have betrayed him in foreign countries. And, you know, it just everyone seems to be shrugging over that. No ramifications for anyone. And second, that, you know, Donald Trump has been you know, harshly criticizing the media as despicable scum, you know, the worst people in the world, nothing but dishonest. And, you know, it led him to believe that this would not be something that would cause him any serious blowback, and that what it would do is sort of exert his own authority and power, not just within his own kingdom, but also, you know, this is a pretty aggressive move against Turkey in its own way. And, you know, what we're seeing here is a lot of jockeying for power in the Middle East, Iran, Turkey, Saudi Arabia, Israel, and these various, you know, sort of shifting alliances, and it's all complicated, but particularly complicated by the fact that, you know, Russia is now involved in the Middle East in a way it hasn't been in many years, and you've got Trump, who, you know, is on the one hand advised by a naive princeling, Jared Kushner, and who has very little understanding of the complexities of these relationships or the consequences of, you know, making these sort of moves. And on the other hand, he's got some hardcore right-wing ideologues who are essentially working on behalf of Israel to confront Iran. And so, you know, this is a very, very, very volatile situation. And this has thrown a bomb into the middle of some plans that were of the New York Times reported last week that the Trump administration had been planning to stage a major confrontation with Iran in November over and basically try to isolate them by sabotaging their oil sales.
Yep.
Which, of course, would and this would be with the backing of Saudi Arabia, of course, who would agree to reduce prices or, you know, up their you know, their oil production or whatever, that this was a, you know, a big grand plan that this has somehow disrupted, because now Trump is sort of having to, you know, I mean, he's not doing it very well because he's basically saying, hey, you know, stuff happens, what can I say? But, you know, this is a very, very volatile situation. And just before I stop here, the one thing I heard that was very interesting to me about how this might affect the midterms is that this has been the most sustained coverage of a foreign policy event since Donald Trump came into office. And I don't know whether that means anything important, but it sure seems like it might, that maybe this is going to have some effect on the midterms.
I mean, it's possible. I mean, before we get there, I mean, I think you raise a couple of there's sort of two aspects, right, that I think are becoming clear. And this is something that you and I have touched upon every couple of months over the last couple of years, which is what are going to be the implications in the context of foreign policy with an administration that is, on some level, fundamentally incompetent insofar as that they're understaffed, they are inexperienced, they are running our foreign policy in the same way that you would if you were a small, undeveloped nation without a democracy, right? They are running our foreign policy as if we were not a nation. And regardless of one's perspective on how much of a source of good we are in the world, right? I mean, because I think people have a range of perspectives on that. What we were indisputably was a consistent watershed that would change our policies, perhaps at the margins. But fundamentally, there were certain things that didn't even need to be articulated on a regular basis that in some ways impacted and regulated the behavior of other countries. And when we come back, I want to take a break. When we come back, I want to talk about that element of it, because there's really two elements to this. There is the sort of the mechanics of foreign policy, and then there's sort of the more broad messages that we send to the rest of the world that are not necessarily tactical or strategic in any way, but they have big implications for the way the rest of the world functions. We're going to take a quick break. I'm Sam Seder. I'm talking to the great Digby. We'll be right back on Ring of Fire Radio. Welcome back to Ring of Fire Radio. I'm Sam Seder here with Heather Digby Parton from Salon. So, Heather, when we broke, we were talking at least ostensibly about the killing of Jamal Khashoggi, a U.S. resident, a Washington Post columnist, a Saudi national, killed in the Saudi embassy in Istanbul. There have been multiple stories. Donald Trump has tried to cover for the Saudi Prince MBS. A lot of people in our neck of the woods have been saying that Mohammed bin Salman is not the sort of reformer that he's been made out to be. Of course, we are aiding and abetting in a humanitarian crisis in Yemen, killing of civilians. This is something, a strategy that started under the Obama administration, but the Trump administration has sort of upped the ante, taken the gloves off, said kill as many civilians as you like slash need. And you brought in the implications of the Iran situation. And so there's two things that are functioning here, it seems to me. One is in the context of like the mechanics of a foreign policy. It's clear that that Mohammed bin Salman thought, okay, the Trump administration wants to go to war with Iran. We do too. We are in bed together, so they don't have the leverage over me that I would imagine they would in other time periods. Like we have jumped off the cliff together, so we're sort of tied together. This may have been an underestimation of the blowback that would come from other sectors in the United States. But that's also a function of no one in the Trump administration communicating to MBS, like, what are the parameters in which you can operate under, right? Because they keep unshackling this guy. At the same time, to have someone like Trump not only opens the door for an MBS to do this, But you look down in Brazil where you have Bolsonaro, the lack of a typical, let's say, U.S. administration which frowns on outright fascist leaders, ones who, threaten to kill gay people or attack women or are racist, allows certain classes in Brazil to say, you know what, we can get away with this. I mean, regardless of what your perspective is on Hillary Clinton, it's hard to imagine certain aspects of Brazilian society wanting to send Jair Bolsonaro to the United States, knowing this guy's a fascist. But now it's like, who's going to make us look in the mirror? Donald Trump? I mean, these two things have an interplay that I think is very problematic.
It's extremely problematic. I mean, and it's not just with, I mean, this is going on in virtually every sort of hotspot that exists in the world. I mean, Kim Jong-un is the perfect example. I mean, Trump's out there saying, and then we fell in love. He sent me, nice letters. I mean, and no one is worse than Kim Jong-un. I mean, he makes MBS or Putin look like amateurs by comparison in terms of just, pure tyranny and genocide of his own people. I mean, he's an absolute nightmare. And there's Trump saying, then we fell in love, which is unnecessary, right? I mean, he could be dealing with Kim without saying that sort of thing and that message that sends, as well as someone like Rodrigo Duterte. I mean, there in the Philippines, he complimented him on the way he dealt with his drug problem, which is basically to send paramilitary forces and mercenaries out into the countryside and just killing drug addicts. He said that he did that the right way and invited him to the White House. So, your analysis is absolutely correct. They're seeing that there is, you've got, the European Union sort of making halfway, sort of tepid responses, but, they've got their own issues going on with the right wing, and with the United States completely abdicating that role, which is absolutely correct. It was sort of, regardless of whether you think it's correct, right, that the U.S. was doing this, they did serve as this sort of fulcrum, in the world order that was just sort of solidly there, and there were certain limitations, and you just sort of expected that this was that you would get a certain response from the United States. That's gone, and instead, what you're getting is kind of a green light. And I can understand why they think so. I mean, I don't necessarily blame these right wing factions around the world thinking that the U.S. is going to turn a blind eye, because they are turning a blind
right.
eye. I mean, sure, there are people in this country who are screaming and yelling, but so what? You've got the government itself, the commander-in-chief of the military. You've got, all of his minions running around. They don't care. I mean, even people like John Bolton, who used to be a Russia hawk and all this, I mean, he's an ideologue. He doesn't say anything about any of that stuff anymore. And in fact, I mean, he seems totally concentrated and focused on starting a war with Iran, which
right.
is what he always wanted. So, you're not going to count on him to step up and say something about Saudi Arabia, because Saudi Arabia is his ally in what he's trying to do. So, this is a very, very dangerous situation, and it's exactly what you and I have been saying. Every couple months when we revisit this, it's always this, this kind of queasy feeling
yep.
that something really bad is going to happen, because this chaotic approach and this kind of, having Trump. I mean, I think that maybe the moment that crystallizes this is Trump at the United Nations.
Where the entire General Assembly just laughed at him. We are, I think, still in the first act of this, Heather, but it could move
yep.
quite rapidly from here. We've got to take a break. If you'll join me in the next hour, we've got a lot more news to talk about. I'm Sam Seder. This is Ring of Fire Radio. Coming up, we'll discuss the violent gang, the Proud Boys, with Media Matters President Angelo Carusone. I'm Sam Seder. We'll be right back on Ring of Fire Radio. Hey, folks, you're listening to the free version of the Ring of Fire Radio podcast. You have no idea what you're missing. You're missing two important interviews and two discussions with Digby about the news of the week. Folks, week in, week out, we produce this show. You're listening to the free version. There's a longer commercial-free version that is available to you for just a couple of bucks a week. Maybe not about $2, less than $3 a week. You can hear the entire program and get access to our entire archives. We're talking about a decade's worth of shows, some featuring Bobby Kennedy, some featuring Mike Papantonio, some featuring me, and guests from across the spectrum in the political world. ROFpodcast.com. That's where you go to become a member. Your support makes this show possible. Thanks for listening. Welcome back to Ring of Fire Radio. I'm Sam Cedar. Last weekend, the far-right group, the Proud Boys, made headlines when they violently attacked protesters in Manhattan. Here to tell us about this group of self-described Western chauvinists, Angelo Carasone, the president of Media Matters. So, Angelo, let's just start with, who are the Proud Boys?
They are probably the most well-organized part of the men's rights movement. And so basically the Proud Boys are, as they would describe themselves, Western chauvinists. And that's just to put it simply. They have chapters, they do meetings. You know, they're not just sort of like participants in online forums like I think a lot of the men's rights movements are. They actually do stuff in public, as we are now seeing.
Okay, we got to go a little broader than that, because I just think that the everything you just said probably strikes normal people as being absolutely bizarre. We have a group of adult males who are in their 20s, 30s. Their leader, I think, is late 40s, Gavin McGinnis. Yep. We'll get to him in a moment. And they all wear Fred Perry collared shirts. And they're in a basically He-Man, women-hater, non-Western civilization-hater group. It's like a youth group, but for theoretically grown men.
That's right, and they consider themselves to be sort of like a fraternal order. They have levels of participation. So, like, the first level is actually, you actually have to identify yourself officially as a Proud Boy, and you have to make that a publicly known statement. It's not something that you shy away from. You have to actually explicitly say that, identify that in some of your either public communications or on your social media profiles. Like, you have to make it known. The second level is when things start to get a little stranger. You have to commit to giving up masturbation. It's a really important part of moving through the ranks, and it's something that they insist people commit to as they sort of go through it. And then as a part of that initiation, what happens is that you get beat up by other Proud Boy members of higher rank while you list your five favorite cereals. And then the third part of it is when you actually get a tattoo, a marking.
You're saying these things like they're not absolutely bizarre. You've got to get beat up while you're saying your five favorite breakfast cereals?
Yeah. Like, and it's a real thing. These are places that have they are a pretty well organized group. They've been growing pretty steadily the last couple of years because they're tapping into this sort of energy that is that sort of percolates within the larger anti-PC men's rights movement. And so it's just like a funnel. You sort of start with big picture kind of stuff, and then you slowly, you know, recruit people and work them down. And the fourth level is where it gets scary, though, and sort of it goes from being weird to sort of scary, is that actually the highest level of being a Proud Boy is when you commit violence for the cause. That's how they describe it. And it is the most honored thing you can do. And you are recognized as such when you get to that level. And what we saw on Friday in New York City, it wasn't just that it was an outlier or a random example of the Proud Boys sort of getting into a scuffle. what they had was a moment where some of them could commit violence for the cause and sort of earn that badge of honor and that distinction. And it's intentional. And when Gavin McGinnis founded it, he described it very proudly as a gang. He really believes that there needs to be sort of a pro-violence movement at the tip of the spear for the larger, you know, men's rights and anti-PC movement. And he's pretty unabashed about the fact that violence is a necessary and effective tool. And, you know, that's kind of where the sort of the culture part of it comes in, right? That when you're sort of moving people through those levels, a part of that is actually to indoctrinate and to get people comfortable, just like any gang, with increasing levels of activity. So it goes from being sort of strange and weird to, in, you know, starting to create those moments of hazing and more intense camaraderie to outwardly conditioning people and incentivizing acts of violence.
If you know, what is this all about where they don't masturbate and how do they, I mean, we'll get on to the more serious aspects of it, but it's, you know, people should know this is a very, you know, bizarre group. And I happen to have known Gavin McGinnis socially years ago. We will talk about that in a moment. But what is the theory behind telling the members of this gang that you're not allowed to masturbate, and how do they regulate that?
I think it's an honor system, and I think that's really a part of it. The theory behind it, I think, is partly connected to a few things. One is that there's this. It's gay to touch yourself a little bit. It's a little feminizing or beta. This is according to sort of their tenets, that there's this hyper masculinity associated with being a Proud Boy, which seems strange given the name, but, and that even doing that act alone is somehow a part of it. The deeper piece, though, is less about their hyper masculine approach and actually more about creating a shared sacrifice and to incentivize more group activities. The idea is that, you know, when somebody moves to that level of commitment, it actually coincides with a hazing experience. And a piece of that is actually that, you're sort of bonding a little bit more with the group. And it's like a gang, right? The idea is to really tether you more to a community in a weird way than to yourself. And so as a part of that, presumably, and as it typically is the case, you actually spend more time at Proud Boy meetings and with other Proud Boys. And you sort of move deeper into this organization.
Now, you refer to this gang as being centered around the men's rights movement and Western chauvinism. Why do you not use the term white supremacist?
I think that that's too easy and too simple. And I actually think that it's not because I don't think that it's not because I don't think that race is a big piece of their organizing principle. It's just too simple. And I think these days the sort of knee jerk reaction oftentimes when these things break into the public is because we think about this kind of activity in the past, typically associated with white nationalists and white supremacists. And because that's often our frame of reference, that's immediately where we go to when we see groups like this, because it feels very similar. And there is no doubt that bigotry and racism and very much anti-LGBT discrimination are a part of their brand, but it's bigger than that. And it isn't purely limited. Their organizing principle is not around race. In fact, as evidence of that, actually at Proud Boy meetings is where actual white nationalist organizations will try to find recruits, because there tends to be very intense alignment. But it isn't the sole their organizing principle. And so I think it's I think it's just a little misleading. And there are people of color that are part of the Proud Boy community. And so when you say that they're a white nationalist group, and then they're like, it actually makes it harder to get to what they're really organizing around. And that's the part that scares me, because they are much more appealing than say the white nationalists are. When you look at Charlottesville, what you saw on display at Charlottesville, not the night of the tiki torches, but on that Saturday when there were all those people there, one of the ways that so many came together was that was that Proud Boy chapters had actually activated themselves, as well as other men's rights organizations, to say, go out and protest political correctness. And so there is something much more appealing and broad about that than simply, you know, white genocide and, you know, white culture is dying and being destroyed. And so I think it's important to be aware of that.
All right. Well, Angela, we're going to take a break. When we come back, I want to talk a little bit more about how they see themselves in terms of these shock troops for the conservative movement that you call that I think we could say is, you know, they're white supremacist friendly, right? Like they're allies of these folks. And then let's talk about Gavin McGinnis. I have some personal experience with this guy. We shared some former friends of his, because and in many ways, this is a cautionary tale. Sometimes it's very hard to watch your friends get super wealthy when you just get a little bit wealthy. And if you have the right emotional problems, it will turn into something like this. We will talk more about that when we return. I'm Sam Cedar. This is Ring of Fire Radio. Back. I'm Sam Cedar. Right now I'm talking to the president of Media Matters, Angelo Carasone, about the right-wing group, the Proud Boys. So, Angelo, we're talking about this group, and I need to catch people up because it's going to sound like we're making this up. There is a group, it's a gang, essentially. They are organized around the principle of Western chauvinism and male rights. Instead of going into the woods and doing drumming parties, what they do is they basically beat up other people. They play their version of a real life knockout game. They tell each other that they're not allowed to masturbate, and they dress up in, tennis gear. And, this is a gang that has chapters around the country. It was formed by a man named Gavin McGinnis. Gavin McGinnis was one of the original founders of Vice magazine. He was forced out because people find him difficult to get along with on a personal level. And he was paid out, I think, a couple of $1 million. But his friends went on to make hundreds of millions of dollars. And ever since then, he has had one failed attempt after another to rekindle some of that magic. He's tried to be a Fox News contributor. Mm-hmm. I happen to know that he would have to take a couple of drinks before he would go on because he was very nervous. And I think that ultimately probably closed off that route. And so here he is now trying to rebrand himself as this, I don't know, would you call it a brown shirt? I mean, where do they see themselves within the, they just see themselves as the shock troops for whom?
They would say, you know, I mean, I think the best example of that is their violent arm, the parts that commit violence are actually oftentimes they themselves refer to them as the Fraternal Order of the Alt Knights. And so I think that answers the question of for whom. They would see it as defenders of, you know, if you ask them who they're really advocating for, they'd say Western civilization, Western principles, which sort of gets back to that whole idea about are they white nationalists or not. Obviously implicit within that is a part of, is tied so much to white identity. But they would say that they are there to be shock troops for the alt-right, for this new movement that is anti-political correctness, pro-libertarian, you know, pro-freedom, and that is honestly what they would describe it as. And you know, there's a lot of doublespeak. I mean, today and over the last couple of days, you know, Gavin's on his own personal program has constantly referred to them as peacekeepers, as keepers of the peace, as people that are out there to actually prevent violence, even though it's very explicit within their organizing principles that they commit violence. So it's hard to really decipher it. You have to just look at what they stand for and what they advocate for, which is essentially, you know, male chauvinism, male supremacy is a very big, important part of that. They really do believe that. And that carries with it, you know, a lot of ideas and notions that are very much aligned with the right wing.
So let's be clear about this event that took place earlier this week in New York. The New York Republican Metropolitan Club had an event that Gavin hosted to celebrate the assassination of a Japanese socialist figure, I believe, from the 1950s. Gavin McGinnis came there with a big sword to do a sort of like a production about it. During the day, and we should be clear about this, there were protests. There was some vandalism. This is during the day. By the end of the evening, the protests had broken up and people were walking away. Three people who were not involved in that protest were jumped by 30 of these Proud Boys. There's a lot of video of this. None of what I'm saying is in any way in controversy whatsoever. They were kicked. They were beaten. They were there were homophobic slurs. There was, you know, anti-immigrant sentiment. And then the Proud Boys, you know, ran away. The cops at the time did nothing. Maybe they didn't know exactly what was going on. Give them the benefit of the doubt. They have subsequently begun a search for nine people who are identified on the videos. But what is your sense? Gavin McGinnis came out and said that I've got friends on the NYPD. I want to thank them. How much do you think that is real and how much is that just his sort of posturing?
I definitely think that's a little bit of bluster, but there has been incidents over the past year where at police departments across the country, officers and deputies have been fired or sanctioned because they have been caught in their personal time either wearing or engaging in Proud Boy activities. So one, there actually is a part of the Proud Boys that intentionally reaches out to and recruits law enforcement officials. It's a really important part of their organizing. They really believe that penetration into law enforcement not just gives them insight, but gives them some degree of protection. I do think he's exaggerating fairly heavy a bit as it relates to the NYPD. I don't take anything that he says at face value, but it's reflective of a deeper intentionality on the part of the Proud Boys. And the other piece to sort of get to the violence piece a little bit is, one of the things they do is they actually have a training program for higher level members around how to instigate fights, right, to actually have these setups, right? I mean, that is a part of it, to actually create these conditions where you can actually look as though you're operating in self-defense. And that's, I'm not saying that was happening here, but actually, you know, there's a lot of events where they are involved in that a part of it is essentially a setup job, that they are enacting essentially a script in order to pretend as though they are operating in self-defense when they're not.
Angela, we just had about 90 seconds left. How does Gavin McGinnis make money off of this? And how many of these Proud Boys exist in this country?
It's hard to say about the number that exists. It's definitely thousands. I would say their growth rate is really steady. You know, I've been watching and monitoring them now for a solid 2 years. And 2 years ago, they were marginal and infinitesimal. And I would say that now they're definitely in the thousands of like steady, active participants. And that's because it's reflective of a deeper environment. And Gavin makes his money largely because Mark Levin is his new boss. And he's in bed with a really big media company, Cumulus Media, which is the second largest radio company out there, has a subdivision called Westwood One that actually distributes his program to companies that pay for it. And that's mostly how he makes his revenue these days, is through that.
On air, over terrestrial radio, or is that just through CRTV?
They had tried very aggressively through to terrestrial radio, and it wasn't clear to me that they were ever able to successfully get any contracts. CRTV and then some smaller digital distribution deals.
Interesting. And who funds that? Is that just strictly a corporate thing? And have people basically said, hey, why are you, why is this major corporation supporting literally brown shirt thugs?
It's weird because CRTV basically pays Westwood One for Gavin McGinnis's program. That's how it, so Mark Levin's company, CRTV, pays Westwood One, which is that really big radio company, for the distribution rights. I mean, they're probably the largest footprint that he has right now. Westwood One has not been successful, but they have other programs that they've been adding that are very similar to Gavin McGinnis. They're just not that much further. And those programs they have had success at getting onto terrestrial radio. So in a way, the whole idea behind Gavin is kind of like the Overton window, right? Is that if you're the tip of the spear and you're really far out there, maybe you're not palatable, but you create a taste in the audience's mouth for something that is close to that, but maybe just not that far over the line. And that's the thing that I feel is the net effect of all of this, is not just the violence, but how they constantly move things further and further. Yeah,
Angelo,
totally.
Thank you so much for your time today. I really appreciate it.
Thank you. Much appreciated.
Angelo Carasone is the president of Media Matters. When we come back, Heather Digby Parton will join us to analyze more news from the past week. That's just ahead. I'm Sam Cedar. You're listening to Ring of Fire Radio. Don't forget, ROFpodcast.com, to hear what you've been missing and to support the show.
I'm a trial lawyer. I've spent countless hours poring through documents that tell the story about the ugliest side of corporate America.
Fraud.
Corporate media refuses to talk about these issues.
The conduct by this company was deplorable.
I'm going to paint a clear picture about how disturbing, how corrupt corporate conduct has become in modern America. These are stories that no one else can tell. I'm Mike Papantonio, host of America's Lawyer. Question more.